Our third case for argument this morning is Hess Newmark Owens Wolf Incorporated against Owens.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please Shelley Colwin on behalf of the
Appellants.
May it please the Court. There are several compelling reasons, we believe, that require reversal of the trial court's denial of a preliminary injunction here. I want to address the most distinct one first, and that's the question of law on the enforceability of the covenant not to compete. The trial court ruled that the covenant not to compete here is unenforceable because the scope of the activity that it prohibited was too broad. In doing so, it rejected Illinois law that found that precise provision allowable on a scope of activity. And in fact, and that's the health professional case we cite in our brief, if you look at the provision in that case and compare it to the provision in this case, they are identical. In addition, the trial court's reasoning for saying it's overly broad, that it prohibits any type of possible work. With all respect to Magistrate Mason, the Illinois Appellate Court found that same reasoning, which was proffered by the defendant in that case, absurd, because what it said was, you have to read these things in the context of what they're being done. Obviously, they're not precluding her from being a janitor or a secretary or something like that. And so the trial court erred by finding the covenant unenforceable. The next, and I think that's also highlighted by the fact that if the court compares footnote 7 of the trial court's opinion, in which it sets out what it believes to be a reasonable scope of activity requirement restriction, and you compare that footnote to what's actually in the contract, you'll find that they're virtually identical, I think, which highlights the fact that the magistrate judge couldn't even write one that would be more precise than the one that was written. So they erred as a matter of law. The trial court's next error of law was it then decided that contrary to all Illinois law, all seven circuit cases that have addressed the issue, and related cases, not in covenants not to compete, but in related areas, that you cannot have a preliminary injunction, you cannot establish irreparable harm when your protectable business interest is endangered, unless you also have actually had damage, actually lost clients. Every case that's addressed this issue has said the opposite. And, of course, the defendants in their brief cited no case to support the position that the trial court was putting forth. So they erred as well. And that, of course, makes perfect sense. So for that reason, on that basis alone, the trial court's decision should be reversed and a preliminary injunction should be put in place. This argument and this reasoning becomes particularly or equally compelling with respect to ongoing breaches of fiduciary duty that the trial court found. The trial court found that there was an ongoing usurpation of corporate opportunity, and still ongoing as we sit here today, that there's an ongoing breach of a duty of loyalty, and still ongoing as we sit here today, as the defendant continues to work for the rival of her company, which she's a shareholder, former director, officer, and key salesperson. And in that regard, the court again found, oh, no, you must show a loss of clients first. No case has held that. And a case that this court decided, which I think is particularly appropriate, the Foodcom case, very analogous. In Foodcom, the salespeople, they were not shareholders, officers, directors, merely salespeople, determined that Foodcom had rejected a contractual offer from one of its key clients to do business. As a direct result of rejecting that offer, it lost 75% of its business. The salespeople decided they would make hay where the sun shines, and went on and pursued that client, and then did it. The Foodcom had not lost the client yet, but obviously its relationship with it was already severely damaged, even before the salespeople acted.
What would they need to do to show irreparable harm?
In this case, well, I believe under the fiduciary duty, I think that they've already shown it. When there's an ongoing usurpation of corporate opportunity, that's irreparable harm. Where they're looking at situations where their competitive position is being diminished in the marketplace. For example, in the Crosswoods case that we cite, when a rival is a former employee, and in this case the named partner of the firm, goes to work for a rival trying to help it expand its markets, its position in the marketplace, that on its face diminishes your goodwill in a protectable business interest.
Are you arguing sort of a per se rule here that a person of the of these characteristics violates her obligations to her firm, that automatically entitles you to a preliminary injunction?
In the covenant not to compete, yes, I think that's what the law is. Otherwise, the covenants not to compete would not have any validity, any force. They'd be mere paper promises. In fiduciary duty, no. It does depend on the facts. But look at the facts here, Your Honor. The facts here is she wasn't just a former employee. She was the founding member, name member, and she still is. Name is still on the door. She goes to work for a rival that's trying to expand into a national firm while they're simultaneously trying to expand into a national firm. For 8 months, surreptitiously, she meets with this company, and as we point out in our brief, she joins the THA team. She agrees to devote 100% of her effort to help them expand their business. She says that the reason she's coming, they say the reason she's coming, and she agrees, is to make studios in Los Angeles comfortable in making a change to this company. She's out there basically diminishing our competitive position. And I guess the perception, especially in Hollywood, as I'm sure you can imagine, is the name of the game. If your partner is out shilling for your rival, it is quickly perceived that you're going under.
The magistrate judge made a finding that she was not soliciting clients, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the law says that you don't have to show aggressive solicitation. I would say, and we submit in our brief, that's a clearly erroneous finding, given the fact that, number one, she was being paid based on the number of markets and studios she got for them. She got an increase of 25% in her income when she helped them get the Warner Brothers studio. In addition, the fact that they got the Warner Brothers studio 2 weeks after she and the THA met with Warner Brothers, we believe those are clearly erroneous decisions. But you need not find that to find that here, her fiduciary obligation was, while she's in an ongoing breach of her fiduciary obligations, that just by doing what she's doing, when their company was formed to try to become a national firm, and we're becoming a national firm is critical to their success of survival, while she's still employed by them and still part of their company, she goes to work for another national firm to help them expand nationally, yes, that is, in this situation, a per se violation. And in Foodcom, this court said, in Foodcom, they said that Foodcom's argument that if the salespeople, who were just fiduciaries, weren't enjoined from doing what they were doing, they would lose their ability to maintain their relationship with their client and might lose the client. Well, similarly here, she's a former director.
Well, of course, there's some evidence that she took the clients away from Allied, but not necessarily from now, isn't it correct?
Well, that is true, Your Honor, but there's 2 points on that. Point one is that Allied was the company that we were potentially trying to merge with, and that was a pretty significant fact since that froze solid once that happened. And secondarily, what she did was she took the clients from Allied in the East Coast markets. The companies have markets throughout the country, and if she's not enjoined, it is just a matter of time before those same clients will then feel they can move their business elsewhere. And if she had presented the corporate opportunity to us, and if she still did, was required to now, if the injunction isn't put in place, THA will be in a situation where they don't have the key salesperson, the publicity and promotional person they need to, quote, make the studios comfortable in making the move. And then they will either have to come to us to acquire us to get Ms. Owens' services or get in a bidding war with Allied, or we will be able to compete with them on a more even playing field. We can go to those studios and say, we have the publicity and promotional expertise that THA does not, who does not have Ms. Owens, which is exactly why they hired her. If they didn't need her for the publicity and promotional areas, there'd be no reason to pay her to do what she was doing. And so that's another reason why she'd be enjoined. So I'm not arguing per se on the fiduciary duty, although when you look at the cases, there's very little that you need show to get it. and throughout all the case law, one thing you absolutely don't need to show, which is what the district court found here, the magistrate found here, was is loss of business. That's what he pinned his decision on. Nothing else. He said no loss of business. Now, he went on to say, even if there was, you know, let's put aside that for a second. Even if I thought you could get one with a loss of business, let's look at the other things we raised. And we raised a variety of areas that he made clearly erroneous findings on. For example, he found that the defendant had no confidential information. Well, if you look at the appendix of the brief, she testified flat out under my examination on adverse direct that she did have confidential information, that she had confidential pricing information, that she never revealed it to the competitors of Haynow, not her prior company, of Haynow, because she knew that they would use it to compete against them and get an advantage. Yet the district court found, oh, well, no confidential information. That defines the term, a clearly erroneous finding of fact. She was not rehabilitated on cross-examination, and the defendants do not address that in their brief as to why. Their only argument is, well, she had other pricing information before that. But that doesn't deal with this pricing information. It would be comparable to perhaps, you know, a named partner at a law firm, while they're still the named partner at the law firm, going to another client that his law firm is trying to get business from and soliciting on behalf of a different law firm and saying, we can give you a better deal because our prices are this, our billing is this. That is extremely problematic and should be enjoined. Similarly, the district court found that there was no solicitation. And I see my time for we've reached my time for rebuttal. If there are any other questions, otherwise I'll reserve it until I come back. Thank you very much,
Thank
Your Honor.
Counsel. Mr. Miller.
May it please the court. As Judge Cuddy suggested, what is being requested here is a per se irreparable harm rule. There's absolutely no jurisprudence in state or federal law which would support such a request. Throughout
well,
the
here you've got the chief rainmaker, the chief salesman for this one company switches sides, goes over to the competition in a pretty flagrant way. How can you justify not having an injunction in a case like this?
Well, just to address that, Your Honor, first of all, she didn't just jump to the other side. She also had her own company, Owens Group Incorporated. This was a unique situation where she was part of a shareholder in a group that was based in Chicago and did Midwest work. She had wore a second hat with Owens Group Incorporated, which was based also out of Cincinnati and whatnot. And she was not
violated her covenant as long as she did it through the Cincinnati company?
Or? No, that's what I'm not suggesting at all. In fact, there was no violation of the covenant, Your Honor, because what is important here is the way the covenant is written, and what Ms. Owens did was she went into the operations of THA, not the sales. And that's what is very clear here, and that's what counsel wants to overlook and wants to attack the court's opinion. Throughout their brief, they, in addition to asking for a per se irreparable harm rule, they assume irreparable harm because they continually suggest that she's out soliciting business. And that all they want to do is have this court substitute their view of the evidence for the judge's view.
Let me explain to you the problem I have with the way you've just described things. And I'm worried that the district court has not done exactly the opposite. That is, that the court has said, seems to have said, I won't find irreparable harm unless you can show an injury that is reparable at law. That is, you have to show a concrete loss of a concrete contract. And if you can't show that, you get no injunction. But of course, if you can show that, then you don't have irreparable injury. You have an injury that is compensable in damages. The whole reason for granting injunctions in these cases is the difficulty, not to say impossibility, of showing the kind of concrete losses that would be compensable in damages. Right? That's my worry, that the magistrate judge has said, I will give you an injunction only if you can show the kind of injury that would make an injunction inappropriate and unnecessary.
Well, Your Honor, what is going on here is that the judge, there has to be, under the jurisprudence, there has to be some evidence of damage. to the corporate customer relationship.
Well, there has to be a case or controversy.
Well,
there seems to be no doubt of that. Mm-hmm. Your client is out there working for the enemy, as the plaintiff sees it.
Correct. All you have to do is potential damage, don't you?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
And here's talking about.
The courts have stated, and here's, I think, a very succinct description of what the rule is. What counsel's arguing is a goodwill-type argument, which, by the way, was not raised below, but I'll get to that in a moment. What's being argued here is that there has to be goodwill, and what the courts have said, and this is in one of the cases they cited, the Prentice Medical Corp.
I think you're getting away from the question I asked.
Well, I don't think the court was not saying specifically that you can only obtain injunctive relief if you can only show actual damage. And by the way, as I say below, as you'll see in the transcript of the counsel's closing arguments and throughout their briefs, they never argued goodwill. What they argued was loss of confidentiality and that her conduct somehow scuttled the Allied deal, both of which, of course, were not proven by the evidence. But what the court was saying, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, was that there has to be at least some evidence of some damage. You can't just have a goodwill argument and a speculative argument that something might happen in the future. And what has to happen, the law is provided in that regard, and plaintiffs show that there was absolutely no damage at all.
Suppose this were a straight trade secret case. Somebody was working as a chemist at some firm and leaves with a very valuable formula. He defects to the competitor, and he defects to a division where new chemicals in the same line of business are being made. Is it essential in order to get an injunction against that defection, against working for the rival, that the plaintiff show that a competing product has already been brought to market?
No, I would say not, Your Honor, and that would be consistent with the Meridian case, which was cited.
But that looks like the kind of thing, some demonstrable concrete injury that the magistrate judge is requiring here. And if it's not required in the kind of trade secret defection case I gave, why would it be required here?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, you have specific admitted stolen evidence that could lead to the loss of business.
The chemist will always deny that he's using the trade secrets for the benefit of his rival.
Okay.
Just as you're busy denying that you're violating this, your agreements.
Well, we're not denying that. In fact, the evidence supported that, Your Honor, and that
was
the court's finding.
Well, you're conceding that you're violating.
Well, no, the court found that. It's not just that we are denying it. The court agreed, and that's the evidentiary finding here.
Hold on.
That we did not
you
violate.
You are conceding that Owens is violating her agreements.
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Then you're denying that Owens is violating her agreements.
What I was suggesting is, in addition to denying that, Your Honor, thank you, is that the court found that.
But in any event, nothing in my hypothetical turns on whether the defendant concedes or denies that he has violated his agreement.
That's correct. If I may, Your Honor, the law in this area is cited by one of the cases cited by Plaintiff Prentice Medical. In this goodwill area where there is no actual loss, and we agree there can be goodwill can be protected and ought to be protected by an injunction. But in those cases, you'll find, and we cited and discussed in our brief, there was all some substantial and actual harm to those cases.
Well, let's talk about losing the Allied deal.
Sorry?
Allied certainly thought this outfit had been damaged, even if the magistrate judge didn't, it seems to me.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, that's again, we cover that in our brief because Allied knew about Mrs. Owens' conduct, knew about Mrs. Owens' CHA work several months before it allegedly scuttled this deal. In fact, the deal is not even off, according to the testimony of its own counsel. What happened was they told Haynow about Mrs. Owens' conduct. He didn't pull the plug at that point. It was only when they ran into court.
In the lawsuit, I assume he thought there was a better legal excuse to abrogate the contract.
Well, there was no contract at that point. All that's going on is actually negotiation is still ongoing. They've exchanged financial information. All that they said were, we want to pause to see what happens as this litigation falls out. That's something that was consistent with the shareholder or the purchase agreement where they negotiated a litigation clause. If there's litigation,
doesn't indicate they thought that the health of the other company was improved by this defection of their of their top salesman.
Well, they apparently weren't too concerned about it when they told Mr. Newmark about it 2 months before they allegedly put this deal on hold. This was in May of 2004. They knew about it. They didn't pull the plug. They knew about Ms. Owens. In fact, what she's doing there, Your Honors, is she's helping them set up offices. She's not selling anything. And why some kind of damage is important is, as the court has said in Prentice, it is well settled that prolonged interruptions in the continuity of business relationships can cause irremediable damages for which no compensation would be adequate. What that's saying, Your Honors, is that there has to be at least some interruption of some, or at least some threat of interruption of a business relationship between plaintiff and their customers. And there is absolutely zero evidence in the record of any business relationship. In fact, Mr. Newmark admitted at transcript 934 that they have no information whatsoever that there is going to be any interruption of business. Ms. Owens has been with THA for nearly 2 years, and there has been no interruption of business between Haynow and any of its customers. There has to be some evidence of a potential interruption of business, not just a speculative, you know, this is going to happen, it might happen, 3 years from now, we don't know when it's going to happen. There has to be some evidence of that, and the court found there is no evidence of any substantial business interruption, and that's what the counsel is trying to interpose their interpretation of the evidence for the judges. And that just is not the way that this court has handled these types of appeals, because it is not clearly erroneous. The judge's findings that Ms. Owens has not solicited and has not caused any loss of business is supported substantially by the record, as we showed in our brief. What counsel, again, is simply trying to do, they don't have evidence of any customer loss. They don't have evidence of any loss of goodwill. There's been no testimony presented to this court. It's simply, it's a matter of course we get an injunction if there's a breach of the non-compete. Of course we get an injunction if there's a breach of fiduciary duty. What's important here, again, is that Ms. Owens is not performing sales for this company. She is not out there trying to take away business from Haynow. She has helped them set up offices in the East Coast where Haynow had no relationship whatsoever. Now they may come up here and try to say, well, in June and July or June and August of 2004, we did do some internet services out there. Well, that was 2 months during 2004. No one told Ms. Owens that they were doing it, and it had nothing to do with the movie studio business. Again, there are several things. As far as the non-compete issue, Your Honors, we submit that that is not a relevant issue because they can't show substantial or irreparable harm. But in any event, the judge did find correctly that he applied the proper test as far as what the company's interest is. The company's interest is not... It's in protecting its assets. It's in protecting its customers. Ms. Owens, again, it all comes back that there is absolutely zero evidence of Ms. Owens causing Haynow to lose any customers. She's simply helping them set up a publicity shop in Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C., where Haynow is not affected whatsoever. Oh, and just one final point. Again, they're claiming that Ms. Owens has all these great contacts, okay? And if you read the transcript, at page 55 and 855 of the transcript, Haynow first claims, well, it's actually price that gets the business. Because if we lose our pricing, if our competitors know our pricing, then they can undercut our bids. But when it comes to irreparable harm, now it's relationships that really matter. So they really want to have it both ways. On one hand, they're arguing, well, pricing's confidential. That's important because it gets the business. But when it comes to irreparable harm, no, really, it's the relationship that matters. So they don't know which side they want to play on this appeal. If you look further at what are the contacts, transcript pages 301 to 305, Mr. Wolf, in his deposition, stated, well, Ms. Owens really only had two contacts that he was aware of. But then at trial, of course, he wanted to say, well, she had substantially more contacts in the industry. Ms. Hess, at her deposition, which is in the record at page 178, in the 6 years that she was at Haynow, Owens obtained only one movie studio client, DreamWorks in Minneapolis. So this is their star person with all these contacts that they're concerned are going to, that she's given away in the marketplace, which, of course, is absolutely no record of that happening whatsoever. Again, at transcript 102 through 104, Ms. Hess, 1002 through 1004, Ms. Hess says that she was primarily responsible for bringing in all of the Warner Brothers and MGM business, not Ms. Owens. So Ms. Owens does not have these extensive contacts that the court, or that the plaintiff would like the court to believe that is, that are in such danger of being lost if they don't have an injunction. Again, to sum it up, they haven't lost. Ms. Owens is performing operations work for THA. She's not performing soliciting business from the movie studios. She has few customer contacts. She's not using those contacts in any way to assist THA. Haynow, by the way, wasn't even expanding at that point, so this argument that somehow they're helping THA expand and not her, or not Haynow, just, again, it's contrary to the court's findings in the appendix, which was by late 2002, Haynow was looking for other alternatives as opposed to expanding. They were selling to Allied, and that was over. And again, to address Judge Cuddy's comment, Allied did not leave this deal because of Ms. Owens' conduct. In the end, Owens' THA work has had no effect on Haynow or its customer base, and we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order of the injunction, of denying the injunction. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Anything further, Mr. Coleman?
Yes, sir.
The defendants would have you believe that Ms. Owens was only setting up offices and therefore wasn't trying to solicit business. The problem with that argument is she finished opening up those offices a year ago, and she's still getting paid $100,000 a year. If she's not out trying to solicit business, what in God's name is she doing for $100,000 a year? That's the first point. The second point is that, and if you look at page 51 of our brief, in which we lay out all the things that she's doing, as Mr. Nemiro, the owner of THA, said when he first hired her, "I'm glad to have you on the THA team." She was getting paid based on how many markets and studios she got. When she got more markets and studios, her income went up. When she said, in one of her emails, she said she was out in La La Land, as we all know affectionately as Hollywood in the business, doing stuff for THA. Well, she certainly wasn't opening up any offices there. She was out with her clients trying to get business. And as her own lawyer said, while they were still together before she fled, "The only reason you guys are doing well is because of her bankable and reliable contacts in Hollywood." That's what she's all about. That's exactly what she's doing. She is the rainmaker. They weren't paying her. Haynow was not paying her $180,000 a year because she knew how to find rental space in Philadelphia or Boston. They were paying it for her bankable assets, and that's exactly why THA got her. And as the DreamWorks executive said, he wanted her on the job because she knew what would make them feel comfortable, not because she knew how to pick out paintings for a wall on good office space in Boston or Atlanta. It's ludicrous. The argument's ludicrous. As far as the Allied deal of tanking, I think, Your Honor, you've got it right on. They had negotiated at length with Ms. Owens, Allied had, for a covenant not to compete, which was a prerequisite of the deal going forward. And she specifically tried to negotiate a covenant that would allow her to do this THA work without ever revealing to them that she was already doing the THA work. And Mr. Matskin, the sharp Boston lawyer, said, "No, we're not going to let you do that." And he cut it off and said no. And she agreed to the exact covenant that she was then violating. And then when we disclosed the material information to avoid later being accused of common law fraud, as corporate counsel did as he should have done, we had found out the exact extent of what she was doing before any lawsuit was filed, before I was hired, before we filed one case. Mr. Matskin, the bright Boston lawyer, said, "Stop. We're not going any farther. Let's find out what this is all about." And they have still not found out what this is all about, except what they've learned in this hearing, and I can say to the court they haven't liked it because the deal has not gone forward since. And if the injunction had gone through, THA would then be in the situation that they would not have Ms. Owens. They would not have the valuable asset to come forward with to make the studios feel comfortable. and we'd be in a bidding war, and our company would have value today, which right now it doesn't, and it's shrinking quickly. Thank you, Your Honor. Based on all the above reasons, we'd ask you to reverse the magistrate's decision. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.